Today we're going to pick up the Revelation series once again, and we're in part 19 of Revelation, and we're headed into Revelation 12 today. And as we've gone through Revelation, hopefully you are starting to pick up the structure of Revelation, because it is a challenging book to wade into. It's challenging because it seems like there's a lot of information coming, and it seems that it's in an interesting order, and it can be a little difficult to sort through. So as we study the word here, it's not important to read the individual details here, but what we start to see is a structure, and we also see that the narrative of Revelation is not terribly different than the way a story might be told. So when we tell a story, we might often start with a story, and then we might pause and introduce something else, or recognize that there's some other background or additional information that's relevant, so then we might interject that information. And then we might get started again on the narrative, and then we might remember, oh, there's more. There's something else you need to know. When we read a book or watch a movie, a lot of times that happens. You'll be tracking on one narrative, and then that will pause for a minute, and you might actually go back in time for a while to see some other characters introduced and catch up to the point where you were, and now maybe the story starts to fold together, and you see how all the different players align and all the different elements of the story come together. So we know that at first in Revelation, we had Christ introducing himself in chapter 1, and then we went to chapters 2 and 3, where he wrote letters to the churches through John. And then we were introduced to the throne room in heaven, and John is now escorted to the throne room, and from there, from that throne room, we start to see the rest of Revelation unfold. And then we got into seven seals. So we had the seven seals that were opened in sequence until we got through the sixth seal. And then there was a pause, an interlude, an intermission. And we walked through the events that occurred in that intermission. And then we went through the seven trumpets. And then between the sixth and seventh trumpet, there was an intermission, and the seven trumpets are a subset of the seventh seal. And then we went through that, we went through another intermission. And then we, in Revelation 11, read about the seventh trumpet sounding. Now we can see here that there are seven bowls that are a part of the seventh trumpet. So in Revelation 11, we read about the seventh trumpet sounding. And we finished Revelation 11 with a coronation, a proclamation of Jesus Christ becoming the king. The woes are, there's a third woe starting. We're introducing another layer, and that the fifth and sixth trumpets were defined as the first and second woe. And the second woe ended, and then there was a trumpet. And the trumpet, or the seventh angel, sounded. And then we also read about, and we can turn to Revelation now, and we read this proclamation and this coronation that we give thanks to God, the one who is and was and is to come, because he's taken his great power and reigned. The nations were angry, and the wrath has come, and the time of the dead, that they should be judged, and that you should reward your servants, the prophets and the saints, and those who fear your name, small and great, and should destroy those who destroy the earth. And then the temple of God was opened to those who were being rewarded here. The temple of God was opened in heaven, and his presence is there. So with that, then, we go right into the seven bowls. True or false? False. They actually don't start until Revelation 15 and 16. Or actually, Revelation 16. We don't get into the bowls until Revelation 16. So what happens in 12, 13, 14, and 15? Well, we're going to jump over to another narrative for a little bit. And we're going to look at these events from a different perspective, and we're going to have some new characters, we might say, introduced. So, as the final set of events is set into motion, now we go into Revelation 12. In this chapter, we're going to see Satan gathering his evil forces, spiritually and physically, to make a desperate attempt to overthrow Jesus Christ in a final climactic epic battle. So we'll get into that here in a little bit. And we're going to see that this event is going to be taking place in the future, in the second half of the tribulation. And so this battle is going to culminate with Satan's defeat, and he'll ultimately be put into captivity. And we'll know that he's in captivity during the millennium. We celebrate that, those truths, on the Day of Atonement and through the Feast of Tabernacles. So John is inspired to write about the characters here in this end-time narrative. And three are introduced: the woman of Revelation 12, a dragon, and a child, a male child. There are three scenes, we might say, in this first section here of Revelation 12. There's the birth of the child. The dragon is introduced, and he has some actions. And then the dragon attacks the woman and her children, or he's ready to attack. And so some refer to this as an inset chapter. I'll give you that definition as well. And we're going to take a look now at this chapter. And so we see in Revelation 12, verse 1, a great sign appears in heaven. A woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and her head is adorned with a garland of 12 stars. So what's going on here? Well, it's a great sign that appears. And so as a great sign, this is a symbol of something. This isn't an actual woman that he's seeing. It looks like a woman, but it's actually symbolic of something. And it's actually, as we know, there can be double and triple fulfillment of certain imageries and certain prophecies. And so we're going to see some multiple different aspects of this. But this woman is clothed with the sun. So what does the sun represent? We've read about the sun multiple times in Revelation. We read it in the context of the brightness and the glory of God. And we recognize that the sun is very powerful. It's a physical manifestation, but it's when we see that something is as bright as the sun, you can't really look at it. You can't discern details when you are looking at it. It's so bright, and we know that that represents power and authority from God. So she's clothed with the sun. She has the moon under her feet. So we'll consider that. We'll consider this symbolism. And I want to take a second here to help us to understand some literary tools. Some of you are maybe English majors and way ahead of us on this, but sometimes we will refer to something in a way that may or may not make sense, and so we may lose some of the meaning as a result. So why don't we take a look at some of these literary tools? A simile is an indirect comparison of something. And so a simile is a tool that is used to help us to understand something, and a simile is saying something is like something else. A metaphor is direct. It's saying this thing is this, but it's comparing it to something else as well. So we can understand a metaphor. I probably should have had some examples here, but I'm defining them. But we'll go through some of this typology here in a minute. An analogy is a proportional comparison. It has shared traits. So something is like something else. So it's shared traits. It's using something familiar to describe the unfamiliar. So this is a powerful teaching tool because sometimes we are working through a complex subject and it's hard for us to understand it. But then when we realize that it's like something else, then we can start to see the comparison and build a little structure in our mind and a framework to hang the information on. A type is something that is referred to. It's a subset of typology. And many times someone from a podium will say, Joseph was a type of this, or Joshua, we might say, was a type of Jesus Christ. Well, what does that mean? He was a type of him. A type is something that prefigures or foreshadows later events or figures. So this is very commonly used in biblical, and I'll drop this term on you, exegesis. So as we're drawing the meaning out of the scripture, those types come in very often because what God will do is help prepare us to understand something by giving us a physical element of it, or a physical analogy or representation, and then we can understand the spiritual element as well. So here's a type, or here's an analogy. The bread and the wine for Passover. It's the body and the blood. That's really like a metaphor. This bread is the body, this wine is the blood. Not literally, but it symbolizes that, and we can understand that. So typology is very common. It's typically a person, an event, or an institution that's being represented or foreshadowed by something else. What we identify and what we learn by studying these different literary tools that the Bible uses so often is we develop an understanding. We also develop the pattern of thinking that God uses to teach us what he wants us to know. But this brings us to a deeper understanding of the text and the meaning of the text. So now we go back to the woman and consider this symbolism. She's clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and on her head a garland of 12 stars. So this symbolic mother, we might say, or this woman, I should read verse 2. Then being with child, she cried out in labor in pain to give birth, and in pain to give birth. So she's with child. So you can notice that she's with child. So she's a mother, but of what? She's a mother of the people of God, and that's represented by Israel, by the church, and then there's specifically Jesus Christ. And we might wonder, well, which one is being represented here? And some would say, well, we really have to understand that it is all three. And there are different scriptures that refer to births and labor pains relative to one at a time. But really here, it appears as though we're coming to understand that it's all three. Let's turn to Genesis 37 and read a reference to basically a one-to-one type here of this woman. As we turn to Genesis 37, we're picking up the story here of Joseph. And Joseph is one of the youngest of his brothers. He has one younger brother, but he has one of the youngest of his brothers, and he's favored by his father, and his older brothers don't love that. In fact, it says in verse 4 that they hated him and could not even speak peaceably to him. This guy bugged them. And then he comes up with something that probably really helped. And he tells them that he has a dream. And so he says, hey, guys, I want to share this with you. I had this dream. Okay, Joseph, go ahead. He says, well, we were all working in the field binding sheaves, and then my sheaf arose and stood upright, and all of yours stood and bowed to me. Not helping his popularity at all. And they said, so should you reign over us? Should you have dominion over us? So they hated him even more for his dreams and his words. And then verse 9, he dreamed another dream and he told it to his brothers and said, look, I've dreamed another dream. And this time the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to me. And so he told it to his father and his brothers. And his father corrected him and he said, what is this dream? Shall your mother and I? So he's decoding this here. Jacob is saying the father is represented by the sun here, the mother by the moon, and the 11 stars being his siblings. Should we all bow down before you? His brothers envied him and hated him, and his father kept the matter in mind. So we're starting to see here that the stars would represent the 12 tribes of Israel. So this is the nation that God, ultimately these guys became the nation that God had chosen. If we turn over to Isaiah 66, we read a section that introduces some of these elements and may help us to understand who all we're talking about here. It says in Isaiah 66, heaven is my throne and the earth is my footstool. So here we see this representation of the earth being the footstool. So this woman has at her feet the moon, which could represent the physical creation as well. God says, where is the house that you will build me in the place of my rest? For all these things my hand has made. And then he's talking about the one on whom he will look. So he's going to select those that he works with, or he's going to invite them and they will respond. And they're going to respond with certain character traits. And then in verse 7, he says, before she was in labor. So this is what Isaiah is inspired to write. She gave birth. She delivered a male child. Who has heard of such a thing? Who has seen such things? And so we see that male child could represent Jesus Christ here. And then it says, shall the earth be made to give birth in one day? So one day, or a relatively short time period, the term for day is yom, one relatively short time period and a nation is born. Well, we know that was true of Israel. Israel came out of Egypt and suddenly this slave nation became a nation. And then over the next 40 years they wandered, but then were established as a nation. But in the history of mankind, that's a very short amount of time for a nation to just be born. So shall a nation be born at once? For as soon as Zion was in labor, she gave birth to her children. That could be the third application here, because Zion often represents, in biblical language, the church. So this is not now necessarily speaking to Jacob or Israel, but now Zion, who gave birth to her children. And so those children would be church members, individual members of the overall body. And that body was defined as a physical nation as one time, and now it's a spiritual nation, as we study often. And then verse 9 says, shall I bring to the time of birth and not cause delivery, says the Lord. And so that could be interpreted as coming to the end time and having described all of these events and not bring them to fruition. So here we are in our physical lives and we look forward to these things. We're hoping for the end time. We have an expectation that these events are going to occur, but all the humans that have lived and died before us did not see or fulfill that expectation, and many of us won't either. But we still live with that hope, and we recognize that God is going to bring it to fruition, which is why we study it today. We learn what these words are, what God's plan is. Revelation 1:3 says, blessed is he who reads and those who hear the words of this prophecy and keep them in our heart. Keep them as our hope. We read or studied hope this morning or earlier in the sermonette and considered how important it is. We have to have this hope. We have to have this expectation because it changes everything about our decision-making process in this life. So we're reading about the all-powerful God who will bring these things to fruition. So we have Jesus Christ, the male child, the physical nation of Israel, and the spiritual Israel. And so now she's with child in verse 2 and cries out in pain, in labor and pain, to give birth. So was there pain associated in any way with the birth of these three analogies or types that we're looking at? Well, with Jesus Christ, we'll go through that here in a minute, of the challenge that he had, but we know that Herod was fired up when Jesus was born, and he and his family fled to Egypt to escape being killed. We have the remarkable story of the physical nation of Israel, and we know that they were in slavery, ultimately in slavery, at first with favor. They came to Joseph, and God had put Joseph in a position of favor and was able to allocate some land for his family. But as they started to grow, then the king of Egypt started to be threatened and wanted them to be subjugated. And so there was pain associated with that, and it was ultimately a series of miracles that brought them out. And then with spiritual Israel, the church, we know that the church has been persecuted really since day one, and that there has always been persecution against true believers. Acts 14, 19 through 23 says, "Through much tribulation we enter the kingdom." So we have many challenges associated with that. So as we look now to verse 3, we see in verse 3 that, turn over to Revelation 12, verse 3 with me, that this other sign appears in heaven, and a great fiery red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 diadems on his head. His tail drew a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth, to devour her child as soon as it was born. And so there's this tension that's created here as we read about this dragon. So it's important to understand that there's some stress and tension here. And so who is the dragon? Who is the dragon analogous of? Satan. We read about a beast anyway in Job 41. So let's turn to Job 41. And Job gives us some wonderful literature, some wonderful analogies, and some explanations of certain constructs, such as this beast, that help us to understand things, even if at first we don't recognize it, because here in this section of Job, we're talking about God's power, his ability to create. And in Job 41, we read of a creature that is really not something that we could define, or this description doesn't attach well to any physical creature that we have. Whereas in some cases, we read about the horse and the power of the horse and the way it will charge into battle. Or the behemoth, which has been in chapter 40 of Job, verse 15, that it could be the hippo or the rhino that eats grass like an ox but is strong and powerful. But in verse 1 of 41, chapter 41, we're introduced to Leviathan, and it's hard to know what that is. So the question is, can you draw him out with a hook? And some say, well, that makes him a sea creature. And possibly that's true. It turns out that as we're reading this definition, that it could apply to a dragon as well. Could you put a reed through his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will he make any supplications to you or speak softly to you? Will you take him as a servant? Will you play with him? You don't make a pet of this beast. Would you trust him with your family? Would you leash him for your maidens, it says, or would your companions make a banquet of him? This is an unclean food. You wouldn't eat it. So can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? Lay your hand on him. Remember the battle and you'll never do it again. That doesn't end well for you. Should you not be overwhelmed at the sight of him? No one is so fierce that he would dare stir him up. Verse 10, who is able to stand? Who has preceded me that I should pay him? This is God talking. So he's saying, who can do this? Everything under heaven is mine. He keeps going. I won't conceal his limbs or his mighty power or his graceful proportions. Who can remove his outer coat or approach him with a double bridle? Who could open his jaws with his terrible teeth? His rows of scales are his pride, shut up tightly with the seal. One is so near another that no air can come between them. They're joined to one another. They stick together and cannot be parted. His sneezings flash forth light, and his eyes are like the eyelids of the morning. They're bright. Out of his mouth go burning lights, and sparks of fire shoot out. Smoke goes out of his nostrils as from a boiling pot and burning rushes. His breath kindles coals, and a flame goes out of his mouth. Strength dwells in his neck. The folds of his flesh are joined together, and they're so firm they can't be moved. Even his heart is as hard as stone, as hard as the lower millstone. When he raises himself up, the mighty are afraid because the crashings are beside themselves. And then we get to the real description here in verse 26 that indicates that he's spiritual and not physical. Though the sword reaches him, it cannot avail, nor does spear, dart, or javelin. He regards iron as straw and bronze as rotten wood. The arrow cannot make him flee. Sling stones, or we might say bullets, become like stubble to him. Darts are regarded as straw. He laughs at the threat of javelins. His undersides are sharp, and as he spreads pointed marks in the mire or in the dirt, he makes the deep boil like a pot. So when he swims, he leaves a big wake and the bubbles and things. He leaves a shining wake behind him. On earth, verse 33, there is nothing like him which is made without fear. He beholds every high thing, and then he is the king over all the children of pride. So this is quite an in-depth description of what this dragon might be like. You can imagine that that's probably the inception of the ideas of dragons. I did look up to see if there are any analogies for animals like this. And we do have some animals, like the Komodo dragon. And it's Komodo dragons are indigenous to a couple of islands in Indonesia. And you might wonder if they swim. And they do. So they will forage for food and they might swim across to another island. Not long distances, but they're comfortable in the water. They're good swimmers. Another analogy might be the iguana. Iguanas are considered strong swimmers, and some are more marine-based than others. There's different versions of iguanas, but they are strong swimmers. They can dive underwater. They will forage for food even underwater and will spend time under there. So this land or sea, this could work, this idea here in Job, and it helps give us some understanding of Satan and how he is the king over all of the children of pride, and that there's nothing on earth that he is afraid of, nothing human, nothing physical. He's red, which is the color of war and destruction and blood, and he attacks the woman. The seven heads represent one of two things. There's a couple of different schools of thought on this. Some might consider it seven successive empires. And so we've reviewed those in other messages in the past. The Egyptian Empire, these world ruling systems and empires. We had Egypt, and then we had Assyria, and then Babylon, Persia, Greek, the Roman Empire, and then what comes after that? The next one, the one to come, the beast power. Some have also speculated that these seven heads represent seven concurrent empires at the end. So I took a quick look at what those might be, and if we were to look at the way the world order is set up today, it could be China, Russia, India, Europe, U.S., Africa, and the Middle East. The ten horns. The ten horns help us to understand that this dragon is associated with the beast, and that it's the one that's giving power to the beast. The ten horns are also referred to in Revelation 17:12, which we'll get to. But ten horns are ten kings which do not have a kingdom yet. So these ten horns are representing ten governments that don't have the kingdom yet. They will receive authority for 1 hour with the beast. So for 1 hour means a short amount of time. They will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them. And those who are with him are called, chosen, and faithful. So we also have a beast in Revelation 13. And as the New Bible Commentary Revised puts it, the dragon is identified with Satan, and his seven heads and ten horns show him to be the Antichrist of the spiritual world, just as his agent, the beast of Revelation 13, is the earthly Antichrist and shares in its characteristics. So he has seven diadems on his head. Who knows what a diadem is? What's a diadem, David?
It's a band that fits on the head. It's just the band itself. It's not. There's no crown. It's like a crown, but it's not a crown. It's just a band.
So David says it's a band that goes on the head, and it symbolizes authority. It may or may not be royal authority, but it symbolizes authority and power. And there are a couple of other analogies. He mentioned a crown as well. Crowns tend to be a little taller, a little more ornate. Diadems are a band that symbolize authority. They might be worn in battle. They might be worn at other less formal times, not a full crown. Also, crowns and diadems are worn by male or female wearers and those in authority, where a tiara is typically only worn by women. But it signals authority and power. And so it's really a counterfeit here, because Satan is trying to assume all authority. And it could also be that this is like a transference of the power that those seven empires had to this government that will show up as the beast power at the end time. Does Satan have the ability to grant worldly power? He does. Matthew 4, we remember, as Christ was being tested, Satan takes him up on a place where he can oversee the world and the glory of the world, and he says, "I'll give you everything that the world has to offer. Just worship me." Was that enough for Jesus Christ? No. But while he didn't take that offer, men do. And men will, and then they have the power and the authority of this spiritual power. His tail drew a third of the stars of heaven. So this dragon has power over spirit beings as well. His influence is on earth and in the spiritual world. So if Satan was one of three, or Lucifer was one of three archangels, it may stand to reason that he had authority over a third of the angels. So as we start to put this together, we could take a look at Job 38, verse 7, to consider the stars being analogous of angels. Job 38, 7 refers to the angels as stars. In Revelation 1, verse 20, we read about the mystery of the seven stars. These are red letters. So Jesus Christ was explaining to John what he's seeing. There's a mystery of seven stars in his right hand. And then he decodes it. The seven stars are the angels of the seven churches. So as Satan draws a third of the stars, these aren't physical stars. They're representing angels which became demons. How many demons are there? Does the Bible give us any clue? Not exactly, but there are some numbers that we can look at. In Revelation 5, verse 11, as we're looking at the throne and the throne room, we read of a choir. And so John says, I looked and I heard the voice of many angels around the throne. There are the living creatures, which are angels as well, and the elders. And the number of them, these angels, were 10,000 times 10,000 and thousands of thousands. How many are 10,000 times 10,000? Say it loud. 100 million. Yeah, so 1,000 times 1,000 is 1,000,000. 10 times 10 is 100 million. And then it keeps going. So he's not saying it's specifically that number, plus thousands of thousands. So there's 100 million and millions more. And they're all singing. So we know that there's at least this many. In Revelation 9 and verse 13, we read of four angels. And I had put a picture up at one point of these four angels that came out of an artist's impression of four angels that came out of the Euphrates. Remember those guys? Kind of creepy looking, strong guys. They were gray and they had chains and they were coming out of the water. And these were these four angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates. I'm in Revelation 9:14 here. And then those four angels who had been prepared for the hour and the day and the month of the year were released to kill a third of mankind. And they had armies with them. So these are presumably angel or fallen angel or demonic armies of 200 million. And they were horsemen, 200 million horsemen. And they saw horses in the vision, and he who sat on them had breastplates of fiery red, bright blue, and sulfur yellow. Well, these have to be spirit. This has to be a spirit army. There's debate on this, but there's only 60 million horses on earth right now. And so I don't know how we're going to get to 200 by the end here. But there's 150 horses, 150,000 horses in Arizona, by the way. There's almost 1,000,000 in Texas. Texas has always got to be bigger and better somehow. It's interesting, this notion of horses and the power that they represent. And you can just imagine 200 million horsemen and how imposing that would be. The power, we still represent power and horsepower. Does anybody know what the average horsepower of a car is today? An average car has about 200 horsepower, which is pretty good, actually. When I learned to drive, the average horsepower of a car was 100 horsepower. And the very best car, I remember driving a car, I had opportunity to drive a Mustang 5.0. This was a cool car. This had a V8, sounded awesome. And I remember it feeling so powerful compared to the Nissan Sentra that my mom had and that I drove. That had 74 horsepower. This thing had three times the horsepower. And for some reason, the back wheels kept spinning, and it was so fun. And now the average car has that much horsepower. So young people, you have far more character today to control that than we did back in my day. We had fun in that car. And so anyway, the average horsepower in 1988 was 100. That was a good car. It's more than double that. But we still refer to things as horsepower. And so even as we get in our vehicles to drive home, we can think about how many horsepower we are in command of at that point. And 200 million here of these demons that are on horses and are coming to kill a third of mankind will be a magnificent sight, I imagine. And if Satan drew one third of the angels who became demons, and there's 200 million here, how many righteous angels must there be? At least. Well, sorry, Mike?
You said if it's 200 million.
And that's one third.
Yeah, then you have to have 600 million total angels.
Total angels. Okay, so 400 million righteous angels. So at a, there'd be 600 million at a minimum, and then 400 million righteous angels. So we can see that these are big numbers. And the righteous angels have their roles as well. So while Satan and his demons are doing their work, the righteous angels are also doing their work. And yet here we see that Satan has thrown these angels to the earth. And as he throws them to the earth, we can read Isaiah 14, verse 12. And I've got it in my notes here. It says, "How you have fallen from heaven, O morning star, son of the dawn." So Lucifer was created to have a very special role. And he was beautiful, but pride got the best of him, and that pride consumed him and ultimately destroys him. And so he's cast to earth. Ezekiel 28, 11 through 19 is for your reference. You could take a look at that this afternoon if you'd like. And it talks about the king of Tyre, but then it makes a transition to where it's pretty clear that it's Satan that's being described here. And ultimately, pride and corruption lead to defilement and ultimate destruction. For us, it's important to consider what we read in Ephesians 6 and verse 12. In Ephesians 6 and verse 12, we recognize that there's constantly this spiritual battle going on. There's not only the physical elements that we see, but there's spiritual elements behind this. And Paul describes this for us as he's introducing the armor of God, the spiritual armor. He says in verse 12, "We do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but principalities and powers and the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up spiritual armor to get ready to fight these spiritual battles." So we have spiritual battles to fight, as have God's chosen always. So as this dragon stands to devour the child, we can consider that the Egyptian persecution. If we turn over to Exodus 1 and verse 8, we'll just now read about some of these challenges. Exodus 1, verse 8, there's a new king arises over Egypt. So the Pharaoh had given Joseph and his family land, and they occupied that land. And verse 7, it says, "The children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them." So the new king comes and says, he didn't know Joseph, and he says, "Look, this people are becoming too many and strong and more and mightier than we, so we need to do something about this." So they made their lives harder, but they still had more kids. And then he makes a decree, and he says in verse 15 of Exodus 1, "The king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives," of whom it gives their names, and he says, "When you do the duties of midwife for the Hebrew women, if it is a son, then you shall kill him. But if it's a daughter, then she shall live." And so they did not do that. The midwives just couldn't and didn't. And then Pharaoh gets upset about this. And in verse 20, Pharaoh commands all the people. He says, "All right, now I'm enlisting everyone. I'm deputizing you all. Go kill the Hebrew males. And every son who is born, you shall cast into the river. So he's probably recognizing here that it's too much to ask for them to kill them. But he's saying, just throw them in the river. The river will take care of it. And then you don't have that. It would be very hard to do. But he's saying, everyone who's born you shall cast in the river, and every daughter you shall save alive. And so here we see this gruesome human edict to kill babies. But where is that coming from? Satan. We recognize that the atrocities that humans are able to commit against other humans are all inspired by these spiritual forces. And we can go through time and think about what humans have done to other humans and why. But Satan, in this case, wanted to make sure that who didn't arrive on the scene? Moses. He wanted to make sure he knew what was going to be coming, and he knew that Israel was going to become a great nation, and Satan wants to do everything he can to oppose God's plan. Well, if he was upset about Moses, do you think he was upset about Jesus Christ coming? Let's jump over to Matthew. And as we're in the early chapter here of Matthew 2, and we're being introduced to the time into which Christ came, we're reading about Jesus and his mother and Joseph, what became his stepfather. And then in verse 2, or chapter 2 of Matthew, we pick up the narrative here. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who's been born king of the Jews? For we know that he's been born. They saw the star in heaven, and we've come to worship him." And when Herod the king heard this, so he sees these guys in Jerusalem, he says, he's troubled, and all of Jerusalem with him. So he gathers all the chief priests and scribes, and he inquires of them, "Where was Christ to be born?" So you guys know, you've read the prophecies, where is this supposed to happen? And they said, "Well, it's actually not in Jerusalem, it's in Bethlehem." So in Bethlehem, they read the prophecy. So Herod, when he had secretly called the wise men, so he says, "Okay, so now I know you're going to Bethlehem, here's what I need you to do." He says, "Go find this young child, and when you found him, bring him back word to me that I can come and worship him also." So this was his plan, to get in the presence of this baby and kill him. So when they departed, they behold the star which they had seen went before them, and they went to where the child was. And they rejoiced with exceedingly great joy. And so then they saw mother, and they had time with him. But then verse 12 says, being divinely warned in a dream they should not return to Herod, they departed for their own country another way. They decided, we're not going back through Jerusalem and dealing with Herod. So when they had departed, an angel of the Lord appears to Joseph in a dream and says, "Take the young child and his mother and flee to Egypt and stay there until I bring you word." So the situation is going to get hot here in Israel. You're best going off to Egypt. And Herod, it says, Herod will seek the young child to destroy him. And so they did that, and it fulfills prophecy. So we know that there was a prophecy that says that out of Egypt I called my son. But Herod, when he saw that he was deceived by the wise men, was exceedingly angry in verse 16. And he sent forth and put to death all the male children who were in Bethlehem and in all of its districts from 2 years old and under. So you can imagine how distressing this was in Bethlehem, and how gory and how demonic this was, all to kill Christ. So Satan wants this power eliminated. And so this, by the way, this narrative is not unfamiliar. A lot of times what we see in different types of literature and stories, it's common. It originates with the biblical narrative, but then there's other types of stories that are extra-biblical. Expositor's Bible Commentary says, "The basic plot of this story is familiar in the myths and legends of the ancient world. A usurper, doomed to be killed by a yet unborn prince, plots to succeed to the throne by killing the royal seed at birth. The prince is miraculously snatched from his clutches and hidden away until he is old enough to kill the usurper and claim his kingdom." And that, my friends, is in many ways the story that we are reading details of now. So we talked about Egypt and Satan's role then. We've talked about Jesus Christ and how the dragon or Satan wanted to kill Jesus Christ so that he never reached maturity. Let's make it personal. What about you? What does Satan think about you? What is his approach towards you? Let's turn over to Mark 4. In Mark 4, we read a story that Christ told, or a parable, and he talks about this sower of seed in verse 3 here, that the sower goes out to sow, and it happens when he sowed that some seed falls by the wayside, and the birds come and devour it. Some fall on stony ground, where it did not have much earth, and springs up, but because it doesn't have much depth, when the sun comes, it burns up. Some seed fell among thorns, and the thorns grew up and choked it. Another seed fell on good ground and yielded a crop that sprang up and increased and produced some 30-fold, some 60, and some 100. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. So later, he's with his disciples, and they don't understand. When he was alone, those around him with the 12 asked about the parable. And he says, they're saying, "Tell us what this means. We're not quite getting it." And in verse 13, he says, "Don't you understand? The sower," verse 14, "sows the word," sows the truth. "These are the ones by the wayside where the word is sown. When they hear, Satan immediately comes and takes away the word that was sown in their heart." So if Satan can win quickly, he will. He'll quickly try to snuff out the word. This is happening as people today, and even as you are processing what you hear in church services, as you read God's word, as you study God's word, as you read the articles, as you allow the word and God's spirit to connect with your spirit and become children of God, Satan is trying to destroy you. He's trying to snatch it from your heart. He's trying to snatch you. He's trying to snatch your kids. He's trying to snatch everyone that you care about. He wants them destroyed. He wants fewer and fewer human beings to become spirit beings and to outrank him. He knows he loses. He never stops this fight. So he tries to snatch the word immediately. Right there, just like he was with the children, and to kill them, he's right there waiting to kill us. This is something we should take soberly. Hopefully now, as we think about Ephesians 6, which we already read, we recognize the spiritual battle that we're in, and we consider that spiritual armor. So then he keeps going. Verse 17. "So then there are those who receive the word and immediately spring up." So it reaches some level of fertility, and they immediately are interested in it. But then they don't have the root. "So when tribulation or persecution arises for the word's sake, they stumble." So when they start to lose friends, when they lose a job, when something doesn't go well for them, then they stumble and their faith burns out. And so that's another tool that Satan can use. Verse 18, "Now these are the ones sown amongst thorns. They are the ones who hear the word. And then what happens? They start to grow. But then the cares of this world, the deceitfulness of riches, And the desires for other things enter in and choke the word so that it becomes unfruitful. Have you heard of the prosperity gospel? Anybody? Are we awake? Yeah, certain people will teach on biblical principles. There are biblical principles that God has put in place so that if one is generous, then there's a principle that God tends to bless that, and others bless that and respect and appreciate that. The point I'm getting to is that prosperity is also a tool that Jesus can, not Jesus, but Satan can use. Does Satan use prosperity to get to some people? Yeah. And we can even fall prey to that. We can be blessed too much. He can give us too much, and then we get to the point where we don't need God. Or I'm too busy doing other things. Or my identity now is tied up in something else, an accomplishment, an achievement. And we lose sight and value less what has been given here. So that's what Christ is teaching, that the cares of the world and the deceitfulness of riches and the desires for other things, whatever might become a God that puts himself in place of God. And that's the first commandment. Let nothing come before God. And then finally, these are the ones sown on good ground who hear the word, accept it, and bear fruit. And so that's what we hope to be. So Satan is operating in the same manner that he always has. He wants to devour, he wants to destroy. And he will be successful with some. His only victory left is to take you with him. That should be chilling. He won't stop, ever. Not until he's put away or until your last breath. Let's go to verse 5. Revelation 12. So as the dragon stands ready to devour this child, verse 5 says, she bore a male child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron, and her child was caught up to God and his throne. So Genesis 3 records the story of Satan getting to the first humans, and then there's a proclamation in Genesis 3. Genesis 3:15, we read the first prophecy regarding Jesus Christ. And God says to the serpent, because you have done this, you're more cursed than all cattle, more than every beast of the field, and on your belly you shall go. And you'll eat dust all the days of your life. And I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your seed and her seed, which is capital S. It's referring to the one who becomes Jesus Christ. There will be enmity between humans and Jesus Christ. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. And we see that there's this animosity between Satan and the human Jesus Christ, who became a human and ultimately was killed by those under the influence of Satan. Isaiah 9:6, though, is a prophecy that can't be denied and will be fulfilled. And so we come to understand what God has in mind. In Isaiah 9 and verse 6, it says, unto us a child is born, capital C, child, and unto us a son is given. And the government will be on his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end. Upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, to order it and establish it with justice and judgment from that time forward, even forever, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. So, regardless of Satan's efforts, all of his attempts will ultimately be thwarted. And we read in Acts 1, of Christ returning to heaven. And his disciples saw it. They saw him go up and return into the heavens to his Father. In Revelation 1, we hear from Jesus Christ directly introducing himself. And in verse 4 of Revelation 1, we read, "Grace to you and peace from him." This is now the one who ascended to his Father and is now with his Father at his right hand. "From him who is and who was and who is to come." And so he's introducing himself, and he says in verse 8, "I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, who was and who is to come, the Almighty." These are red letters. So both God and Christ are described in this way. And in verse 7, he says that "I'm coming back, and every eye will see him." It's speaking third person here. "Even they who pierced him, and all the tribes of the earth will mourn because of him." Amen. So be it. This will happen. And why will all the tribes of the earth mourn? Because they rejected the message. For the most part, most do. They were under the influence of Satan, and they rejected the message, and now they feel the pain. And so we read that this child was born. Jesus Christ was born. He did fulfill the prophecies. The church was created. It did happen. Israel as a nation does exist even to this day. And so these prophecies are always fulfilled. Satan is thwarted every time. And now it says, verse 6, and we'll finish with verse 6. "The woman fled into the wilderness, where she had a place prepared by God, that they should feed her there 1,260 days. So where is this place in the wilderness? How many of you have already bought a piece of land there? How many of you have a timeshare where you're planning to go? How many of you have an idea of where it might be? This has been the subject of a lot of talk. And how many of you are worried about having to go to this place? How many of you really want to go to this place? Wherever it is. I hope they have coffee there. Can you imagine 1,260 years with a bunch of grumpy people with headaches? I imagine it would go away over some time, but these are things I worry about. But the point is that there's going to be this place, and it does say that she should be fed there and nourished. So I have to believe that that's part of it. But this 1,260 days is this time period. We're out of time. I'd like to share with you that there's a couple of ideas about how that could have already physically taken place with the day as a year analogy, but let's keep it real specific to us, is that this is future looking, that the woman, in this case, the church, flees into the wilderness where she has a place prepared by God. So there's going to be persecution. We can turn to Matthew 24 and read what Christ had to say about this. In Matthew 24, if we turn to verse 9, this is some of the last words that Christ spoke to his disciples, and he's preparing them and us for what's going to come. He says, "Then they, the world, under the influence of Satan, will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you. You will be hated by all nations for my name's sake." He could be talking about the Jews. He could be talking about the nation of Israel, which is still hated. How many times have you heard the word anti-Semitism lately? Has anybody heard that? Anybody read it? Anybody seen it on the news? You can't not. It's everywhere. Because this influence is alive and well. They are very recognizable. The Jews in particular are very recognizable. The nation of Israel is very recognizable. Satan hates that. This is one of these categories of people that he hates, and he inspires the whole world to hate them. Everywhere through generations, there has been this animosity towards these people. Now we see why. It's Satan that inspires this, and that will never stop. Jesus Christ is explaining it here. And by the way, as the spiritual nation of Israel, you also fall into that special category of those that are hated by Satan, and he will inspire those to hate you as well, cause you to feel different. He'll do everything he can to choke the word out of you. Christ says, this is going to be the way it is, though. Many will be offended. They will betray one another. They will hate one another. False teachers will rise up and deceive many. They'll make it easier. They'll say, this is a different way. And it's under Satan's influence where the times have been changed, the days have been changed, and it's part of the secular system apart from God, although it looks like religion, but it isn't. False teachers. Christ spoke about false teachers throughout his whole ministry. And then lawlessness will abound. The law is done away. You can do whatever you want. The love of many will grow cold, he says. But, verse 13, he who endures to the end shall be saved. And that's the lesson for us, that if we persecute or if we endure the persecution, then there's salvation that's being made available to us. The gospel of the kingdom in verse 14 will be preached to all the world as a witness, and then the end's going to come. It's going to come. We can count on that. If we turn over to Luke 21, and verse 12, it says again, and this is Luke's version of the same message, before all these things, they will lay their hands on you and persecute you, delivering up to the synagogues and the prisons. You'll be brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake. But it's going to turn out good because you'll be able to speak the truth to them. We read many stories in the Bible about even Stephen before his death, or others before their death are able to give a message at that time. But as he tells you what's going to happen, and he's giving, in essence, an outline of what we've been reading in Revelation, of the powers of the heavens being shaken and these different end-time events, he gives us something to leave with, and we'll leave with this as a congregation today. Take heed to yourselves. This is Luke 21:34. Lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing and drunkenness and the cares of this life. We're going to see a lot of that in the next few weeks. You'll be invited to parties as you have a social network. If you're at work, there'll be the company parties. There's going to be opportunities to participate in these things. And when you don't, you're going to be perceived as different. Expect it. Don't let your heart be weighed down with it and the cares of this life. And that the day come on you unexpectedly, for it will come as a snare to all of those who dwell on the face of the earth. But watch, but be paying attention, but be looking forward to these. Recognize these patterns of behavior that we've studied today, that you may be counted worthy to escape all of these things that will come to pass and stand before the Son of Man. That's what we can pray. It says, pray that we're counted worthy so we can look forward to this day. God will give us what we need. He will help us. He will show us where this place is in the wilderness. 1 Corinthians 2 says, eye hasn't seen and ear hasn't heard, nor can we even imagine the things that God has in store for those who love him. So it's going to be bigger and better and beyond anything that our human minds can imagine. So let's pray that we make it there. Next time, we'll see a war in heaven and a war on earth. We can look forward to that. Happy Sabbath, everyone.